moment, we'll just go around and do some introductions. And let me review the agenda so that we all know what we're doing here. And then we'll go around and do some introductions. So my name is Tanya Carlo. I'm a facilitator with the Consensus Building Institute. I've been working on Sigma implementation here at Dubuque County since a year, at least now, a couple of years. And this is a pretty exciting day because it sort of represents the next phase of work of groundwater sustainability planning. We've been having a lot of governance discussions, and this advisory committee came out of those discussions. It's an important part of the governance. And today we will talk more about that when we get to the charter. So I just want to welcome all of you on sort of this, our first sort of flagship meeting of the BioChat. So looking at the agenda really quickly, this is because this is a Brownhouse Compliance Committee, which has been appointed by the board of the Bioenergy Groundwater Sustainability Agency. We follow all Brownhouse compliance, and in doing so, I just want to make it clear, first of all, I want to welcome the public who are sitting in the back, and after I review the agenda, I'll go to you to see if there are any items that aren't on the agenda that you would like to address, realizing that we cannot take any action on any of those items, but we certainly can listen and then determine if it would require agendizing for future meetings. So I'll come to you, and that would be just for items not on the agenda. Then we'll have a presentation from Dubuque County Water Department. Kelly Peterson will be giving us a Sigma background, and then Kelly will be going into some basin conditions, and then we'll give us an update sort of on the status of where we are with the groundwater sustainability planning. Then we're really going to talk about, since this is your first meeting, we want to make sure everybody is grounded in the same understanding of what the roles and responsibilities are of the SHAC and how it's related to all the other components of VINA sub-basin GSA governance. And so we'll talk a little bit, we'll get your charter, we'll talk about your charter. We will talk a little bit about Brown Act compliance, and then we'll look at the communication and engagement plan. And then I'd really like for us to set your schedule for the next 6 months, so everybody has it on their calendar, and then you'll notice that we have a framework in place so that you know the main topics that are we expect to address over the next 5 or 6 months. So with that, let's go around and introduce ourselves, sort of your name, your affiliation, and because this is our first meeting, it would be great to just hear it, just a very quick snapshot of why this is important to you. You applied for these positions, and yeah, I think it's really important to understand sort of what motivates you to be volunteering a pretty significant amount of your time. And I'm sure we're all grateful that you did decide to apply. So your name, your affiliation, and sort of why you're here, why you apply. And we'll start up here with you, Greg.
Okay, I'm Greg Sonnery. I farm in Butte, Colusa, and Yuba counties, rice and almonds. I've been involved in the water process since the substitution program we got in 94. And out of that, did help with Measure G and Measure F. I've served on many different committees with Butte County Water Department since then.
Thank you, Greg. Gary.
Gary Cole. Live south of Chico, about 10 miles, close to 7 acres of farmland, and rice and almonds are the products. And also, as Greg, I have been involved since 94 in water issues and served on a variety of county committees and so forth.
Great, thank you. Bruce?
Bruce Smith, live in Chico, have a couple of rentals that I work on. Been interested and met Gary, early 90s, 94 probably. Went back to school, studied hydrogeology, got a degree in hydrology, have followed groundwater meetings through GPAC Sigma for years, built a groundwater model for my thesis, very interested in how the conceptual model was developed and used to manage groundwater.
Chris Madden, I work in facilities planning management out of New College. Have a lot of interaction work in utilities and energy out there. Since water is one of our utilities, we supply to the campus. We've got anywhere from 14 or so thousand people living on campus in a day, so we have kind of a mini city there. We extract water out of the ground out of our three domestic wells we have, and we also replace it back through our involved. I want to be involved because I've got a lot of background in data analysis and analytics behind all of our water decisions.
Excellent. Thanks, Greg. Sherry?
Hi, I'm Sherry Chesky.
Oh, Sherry.
I'm currently the sustainability manager at Chico State. I've been on campus for the last year. Chico State's an interesting water user because we do have we have an 800-acre farm, so we've got some agricultural activities, but then obviously our campus is a huge chunk in the core of the city of Chico, using water for a variety of purposes. Prior to my time on campus, I was at Sierra Nevada Brewing for 12 years as their head of sustainability, which I spent a lot of time on water issues. The one ingredient in beer. So, yes, glad to be here. Thank you.
Joshua Pierce with Elemental Management. I've been involved in sustainability primarily from the development construction community for over 20 years. And last 10 years I've been primarily working on renewable energy, but as more and more options for clean energy are becoming available, water is kind of the next big passion project for me. And so I'm here to be a lifelong resident of Butte County, a few Johnson and other places. Back here, really passionate about this project, representing domestic well users, but also on the Cervant side, representing sustainability within the development community as it relates to how we use our water and construction development.
Excellent. Thank you, Joshua. George, do you have your tent?
What?
Oh. Your table.
I do. I was just laying on. I'm Miller Farmer of California Water Service. I'm the district manager for Chico, as well as Oroville. I'm a Chico State graduate, civil engineering. Spent 9 years at South Southern Water and Power in Oroville, 12 years at Paradise Irrigation District, and I've been with Cal Water for 2.5 years. Also served on the Butte County Water Commission for almost 10 years, and most of that as chair, so I've kind of been involved in Butte County water issues.
Thank you, George.
So my name is Gene Brobeck. I first became involved in water issues back in the mid-90s when the conjunctive use water, groundwater substitution water sales had impacts to Butte wells and domestic and agriculture users. Supervisor Yamaguchi put me on the Butte County Water Advisory Committee, which I served for a year or two. I was also on the Chico Urban Area BMO Committee, where we established the basic management objectives for the Chico Urban Area. And I am currently the water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance. And we're very concerned about the nexus of groundwater management in Butte County with the California water market and what impacts it could have to our domestic wells, to our streams, and to our groundwater-dependent native vegetation like valley oak trees.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim. Ann?
My name is Ann Dawson. I'm a total newbie to water issues, and I joined this because I think the whole future of California depends on managing groundwater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. you for being
That's
here.
That's it.
Ben, we have a line of staff here. I'd like you to introduce yourself, and then we'll go to the public so you can introduce yourself.
Cami Loser. I'm the contract general manager of Durham Irrigation District in North Star Engineering. So Durham is one of the member agencies of the GSA, and so I represent
Durham. I'm Kelly Peterson, the water resource scientist for Butte County Water Resource and Conservation Department. We work with the three GSAs, Wyandotte GSA being one of those, also Butte and the Wyandotte Creek GSA, and I'm on the management committee for the Spina GSA and also the Wyandotte Creek GSA.
Good morning, I'm Christina Buck, also with Butte County Water and Resource Conservation, Assistant Director, and I'm kind of spearheading the GSP development in all three sub-basins with all the work being done mostly by consult teams, but so all three attendees help quite a bit because I'm bringing that forward.
So we definitely schedule a table then. Right. Oh, Christina's there in the corner.
Linda Herman with the City of Chico, another GSA for the Pine Sub-Basin. I'm one of two team members that are on the management team. Eric Gustafson, who couldn't be here today, is the second one on the committee. He's our Public Works Director, Operations and Maintenance. So I just wanted to a couple housekeeping items. I know this room might be new to people. There are restrooms down the hall that way, and then there's also an elevator if anybody needs assistance with an elevator as well. So.
Thank you, Linda. Yes. And so let's go ahead and get introductions from the public.
Dan McManus, hydrogeologist and private citizen of Chico.
Eric Lundberg, a world manager.
David Keene, California Water Service.
Thank you all for being here. We are, you'll notice there's a device on the chair in the middle that we are recording this meeting to make sure that we are capturing the proceedings. In case anyone wants a full record. Because what we will be doing when, in terms of our written documentation of these meetings is we will create a high-level meeting summary, which really states our recommendations, whatever our agreements are, action items, and key discussion points. So they'll be pretty high-level, but we will have a full record that is recorded. Just wanted to inform you of that. Now, going to any public comment, is there any public comment for items that are not currently on the agenda? And if you have them, we just ask you to not exceed 3 minutes, just in the interest of time. Anything? Okay. Thank you. Let's talk about just some Sigma background. Now, many of you probably have heard about Sigma, know about Sigma, and probably heard this presentation many times. But we just wanted to make sure that we're all sort of grounded in a similar baseline. So I'm really only going to give you like a 10 to 15 minute background presentation. Can you all see that okay?
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there a glare from the windows?
Are you okay? All right. And is everyone able to hear? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Excellent. So here's just a bit of Sigma background. It is the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which is actually a package of three bills, which came to be known as Sigma. And there are the bills if you were interested in looking at them. At this time, after the last round of basin prioritization, there are approximately 100 groundwater basins in the state of California that must comply with the law. And I'll give you a little more information about that in a moment. Of course, the Vinus Basin is one of those, and it is a high priority basin. The Sigma states that each basin must achieve sustainability within 20 years of submitting its first groundwater sustainability plan. So in this basin, The plan is due on January 31st, 2022. And by 2042, 20 years after that, you need to have achieved your sustainability goal as specified in the plan. Of course, the Department of Water Resources and the State Water Resources Control Board aren't just sort of sitting around to see if you actually achieve that in 20 years. You do need to submit annual reports to the state and do five-year GSP or groundwater sustainability plan updates so they can see that their trajectory is moving towards sustainability. And as I've already referenced, the way sustainability is defined and then determined is through the development of a groundwater sustainability plan or of what is often referred to as a GSP. What's really interesting about SGMA, unlike a lot of other sort of regulatory, laws that have a regulatory framework, is that it really does, their local control is a real hallmark of the law. So that's why all these groundwater sustainability agencies needed to be formed, because they're actually the agencies that are responsible for the development and implementation of the GSP. So they are the local managing agency. And the state, I'll get to in a moment how what the roles and responsibilities are under SGMA. But that local management is key. And then there you can see on the right is just how the definition of as SGMA defines it, the management and use of groundwater in a manner that can be maintained during the planning and implementation horizon 50 years without causing undesirable results. And we will get into what we mean or what the legislation and then the regulations that implement that legislation mean by undesirable results. Any questions on this slide before I...
Good question. 100 groundwater basins. How many GSAs are there? Do you know?
How many GSAs? I don't know that, but that's a good thing to more than 100.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, there's 103 if they were all.
If there was just one GSA per basin, but that's not the case. Here in Butte County alone, we have two GSAs in this basin, one in Wyandotte Creek, and 11 GSAs in the Butte sub-basin. So in Butte County alone, there are 14 GSAs. But that's an interesting question. We'll find that out.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, it is a fun curiosity. Okay, anything else on this before I move on to the next? All right, and here are the very high-level milestones under SGMA, and that is groundwater sustainability agencies needed to be formed by June 30th, 2017. Then all high and medium priority basins need to have their GSPs done by, as I already said, January 31st, 2022. There may be some confusion for those of you who've been following SGMA generally throughout the state. Critically overdrafted basins, which we are not, this is not one of those, their plans are due January 31st, 2020. So there are going to be a bunch of plans. I don't know, I think 47 or 45, something like that, that maybe that are coming in just in a month or so. And that would be interesting for the rest of the medium and high priority basins to look at them. It'll give us very good information. And so I know that we'll be looking at those with interest. But here, they are due in 2022. And then, as I already mentioned, then there is 20 years you have to have achieved the sustainability as it has been defined in your plan by 2042.
Are there any high priority basins close by us?
This is a high priority basin, but it is not critically overdrafted. The closest critically overdrafted, there are no critically overdrafted basins in the North Sacramento Valley. And many, and there are only very few, most of the foothill and more more mountain county basins are low or very low, with a few exceptions. Like I work in Sierra Valley, which is a medium priority basin, and so they need to comply. But the closest, do you know the closest river they are?
San Joaquin.
Is that closest? Do you know?
No.
San Joaquin, maybe. Most of the critically overdrafted basins are in the San Joaquin Valley, with some exceptions in southern and coastal areas. Yeah. But this is a high priority basin. At this point, it is 100, as you probably know, it's 100% dependent upon groundwater. The entire basin. Okay. So I alluded to this a little bit, and many of you have seen this graphic many times. It's important, I think, for us to understand, we're going to get into roles and responsibilities locally, but in terms of the state, in terms of SIGMA implementation, I think it's important to understand how who are the players and what their responsibilities are. So we've already talked a little bit about the groundwater sustainability agencies. That is the, here there are two of them. The Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency and Rock Creek Reclamation District. Rock Creek Reclamation District and the Vina GSA are going to be entering into an agreement because there will just be the development of one groundwater sustainability plan for this basin. You, as the Vina Sub-Basin Shack, are an advisory committee to the Vina GSA. So that's the local agency here, and it's responsible for planning and implementation. So developing the GSE and then implementing it. And it is the local regulatory agency, right? So if there are to be local fees, they come from the Vina GSA. And we already see in the Colusa Sub-Basin to the west of us, that they engaged a consultant and did a fee study, and they already have fees that they are putting into place. That is not the approach that has been taken thus far in this basin. Then the Department of Water Resources is the regulating and assistance agency. So once the law was passed in the fall of 2014 and went into effect in January 1st, 2015, DWR did a full regulatory rollout, right? They developed the GSP regulations, they developed regulations for basin boundary modifications. There was a modification here previously, part of Tehama County, there was actually more than one modification here. Part of Tehama County was in the Vina GSA, and the Durham area was in a different sub-basin. So there were modifications. DWR developed all of these regulations to be able to implement the law. And now that those regulations have been passed, and then what they'll do is they will also be the agency that is approving or reviewing the plans to determine if they're adequate. Now DWR is in assistance mode, now that they've already developed all the regulations. So they are offering technical support services, they provide facilitation support services, my organization and many others are a part of that facilitation support services program. And they're helping with things like providing money to implement multi-completion wells where there may be gaps in your monitoring network, those sorts of things. So they have a regulatory and assistance role. The State Water Resources Control Board is sort of the state backstop here. The state board is basically irrelevant if the GSA complies with the law. But if the GSA, local GSA, does not comply with the law, the state board can put any basin on probationary status. And ultimately, if corrective action isn't taken, the state board will manage groundwater locally, right? And they have a whole fee schedule, and they will charge the locals to do that. But if there is compliance, then the state board doesn't have a role to play. And you can see here that stakeholders are important, and that's one of the reasons that the GSA has created this, this advisory committee. But that's not the only way that stakeholders are important. The public is important. This law places a very high bar for stakeholder engagement. It says all beneficial users of groundwater, so all groundwater users and uses, including environmental uses, need to be somehow involved and consulted in this law. And that's why the stakeholders have this over, overarching important role to play. Any questions about the roles and responsibilities under?
I have one. I'm reflecting back from a meeting the other night. And Jim asked a question about regulations, if there was conflict between various groups and basins and sub-basins, and then who would decide. And I see the regulation for DWR, or the responsibility is regulating. And I think in the meeting, as well as I could hear the other night, you said that DWR then would be the final decision maker if there was a conflict between two sub-basins. And I just don't fully understand what regulating means, I guess, in their assignment.
Well, I don't know if there were disagreements or conflicts between between sub-basins. That would become an issue for the local implementation agency. They are official agencies, right? And so they would need to use whatever remedies are available. They would, whether that is mediation or litigation, but that would happen at the local level. That's not the DWR's role. The state board, like I said, if there's not a plan that is developed, or if the plan is deemed inadequate by DWR and the state board. Because if a plan is deemed as inadequate, both of these agencies have a role to play in determining that inadequacy. Then the state board would have an enforcement role, right? Regulating here means that everything in your planning process needs to comply with the whole host of GSA regulations that have been developed by the state, right? And so really local conflicts and interbasin conflicts really do need to be worked out at this level. And interbasin coordination is important, especially when you're in a valley like this. We know that groundwater, you know, what happens in other basins and what we do here has an effect on others. So there needs to be that coordination.
And I think just to speak to that point, Gary, make it clear, is that if the GSPs show that there's conflicting differences between what they're thinking on each side of that boundary, and they submit those GSPs, that's where DWR comes in to regulate and say, it's not in compliance. This one's going to affect that one, and therefore, we're deeming it not in compliance. So,
They review the plan.
And they develop the regulations, the GSP regulations.
Right. And so when they review the plan, in that case, they see a conflict, they will state it as such. They may not say that you're completely out of compliance. They may put corrective action into place. And they will determine if the degree to corrective action that's necessary and whether it's important for the state board to get involved. It sort of depends on the degree of the issue. And it's yet to be seen, right? We're going to learn a lot from these critically overdrafted basins because we're going to start to understand the answer to that question with the 2020 basins, because they'll be out in front of us and it'll give us important information. Excellent question. Thank you. Okay, so remember I mentioned undesirable results. So what sustainability, which is sort of a nebulous term, right, what that means in this context is that the law and the regulations, but let me just say the state has determined six sustainability indicators that your plan needs to address. And there they are, lined up there with their various icons. So you have to, the sustainability indicators are lowering of groundwater levels, reduction of groundwater storage, seawater intrusion, which given your geography doesn't really apply here, degraded water quality, land subsidence and surface water depletion, and the important caveat there is where there is an interconnected surface water and groundwater, or where groundwater use may be depleting surface water. So those are the six sustainability indicators. And in a moment, Kelly is going to give you a sense of just sort of the lay of the land, what the current groundwater conditions are. But over the next several months, an important part of your role here at the SHAC is that you will be reviewing draft basin-setting chapters for the plan, which tell you more about what your groundwater conditions are here. And it will come into clearer focus the sustainability indicators where there may be undesirable results, so where there may be problems. So how big of a problem are lowering of groundwater levels? Do you have water quality, degraded water quality here? To what extent? You know, so then you'll begin to understand where you are in these six categories, these six sustainability indicators, and if you have, what problems you have that, frankly, your GSP needs to solve. These pictures here are to show you just, remember I mentioned about 100 basins need to comply with SGMA. Here they are throughout the state. The orange is high, yellow is medium, and then here's a close-up of the Moorstock Valley. And you can see yourself here in the Minor sub-basin is a high priority basin, as are, you know, Corning and Calusa. But in Butte County, the Butte sub-basin and Wyandotte Creek are medium priority basins. So you get a sense of where you sit here in terms of compliance. And then these fractured rock areas, these are either low or very low. So these are the only basins in the North Sac Valley that need to comply with the law.
I've got some questions. You set six standards, starting with lowering groundwater levels. Obviously, the groundwater goes up and down during the course of irrigation season.
Yeah, right.
And it fluctuates year by year, depending upon if it's a wet year or a dry year. So identifying what that even means, lowering groundwater levels. I understand we're talking about historic trends. That makes sense.
Right. Well, of course, there's elastic and inelastic, lowering of groundwater levels, right? If there's a downward trend, and we're going to find out more about that from our, scientists and from the work that David's engineering is doing, but you're absolutely right. There is a natural variability or fluctuation that occurs in groundwater, but we're looking at where we know where the problem spots are, where there's a downward trend.
There is, and identifying the impact from adjacent groundwater sustainability areas is something that scientifically needs to be expanded upon. But we do know that the impacts do occur from one area to the next. For instance, when Glen Cruz Irrigation District back in, I think it was 07, did a deep aquifer testing where they turned on the pumps and left them on for a certain amount of time, and did an isotope test. They found out that the water was being recharged presumably from the northeast, in other words, into the Buchanan Foothill area, in our sub-basin. So lowering of groundwater levels in one area can impact another area. So that complexity really needs to be, especially in areas that are vulnerable to adjacent ones like we are, the importance of developing a monitoring network to understand the flow of direction and who's causing the lowering of groundwater levels and what constitutes that. Reduction of storage. Now, I don't know for sure if that's defined on usable storage because there's, when you have groundwater banks, they kind of identify how much water is stored by how much they can lower it and raise it every year. Mm-hmm. So identifying what storage even means, I think, is really important. You mentioned seawater intrusion, but saline intrusion is an issue in the Central
Valley. Yes, that would be a degraded water quality. Seawater intrusion really means where there is intrusion from the sea. So, but it is a water quality constituent.
Right, and it's a similar mechanism to seawater intrusion. If you release the pressure in a confined aquifer too much, you can get a cone of ascension from the salt water that underlies, which is most of the water in the Central Valley is salt water, and it's the fresh water that kind of floats on the surface. So I like keeping, I think seawater, because that is seawater, it's ancient seawater, but still the salt water underneath it is an ancient seabed, so I like to
look, we'll see how the, you know, Christina can speak to this, and then we'll see as this comes. Right now, I'm just giving you a high-level sort of definition, but we are going to go into great depth on all of these sustainability indicators, right? And then you will be able to, you will see every bit of this plan, right, in draft form as the advisory committee. There's going to be a lot of roll of your sleeve sort of work here, which I know you're really looking forward to. And so we will get there. And we'll see how it's being explored and defined. And I'll leave that to the, you know, the scientific and the technical team to work with you all on that.
And so the final parameter in that surface water depletion, I'm very interested to find out what the baseline is. Mm-hmm. Because we already know that there's been huge losses to stream flow associated with groundwater declines. So I'm curious to know what the baseline we're going to use for surface water depletion to see if we can actually restore some of these connections between our smaller streams, which provide critical habitat for salmon and the main stem of our rivers, both the Feather and the Sacramento River.
Yep, that's, the baseline is going to be important. There's sort of some baseline standards that are embedded in the legislation, but it's also a local decision. And then when we get into the discussion of sustainable management criteria, and Kelly is going to talk more about that, she can give you more details about that. Because then how we have conversations about the sustainability goal, minimum thresholds, measurable objectives, she'll get into what all that means. It is, on some level, a technical discussion, and then on another level, a values-based discussion. Because not everyone can have the same tolerances or the same viewpoint. And so that's going to be something that we'll have lots of conversations about. So more to come, for sure. Let's see, I may have already covered this. Yes, I have. It was just sort of defining all of these, the sustainability indicators. And this is just such a funny thing. It's used in the legislation. And I just thought it would be useful to just sort of try to define what we mean by undesirable results, because it's used in the regulations. When you look at all the sustainability indicators, how that undesirable result would be defined is, for example, chronic lowering of groundwater levels indicating a significant and unreasonable depletion of supply if the trend continues. That would then be that indicate that you have an undesirable result that your plan needs to address in this sustainability indicator of lowering groundwater levels. And it goes on that way, right? So if you have a significant and unreasonable reduction in groundwater storage, you have a significant and unreasonable blah, blah, blah. It goes on like that. So that's how undesirable result is defined in SGMA. Is it significant and unreasonable? And you need to determine what you consider to be significant and unreasonable when establishing your sustainability goal. And that is going to be a series of conversations that is informed by the science, right? And I think we've had discussions we've gone along here, but if there's anything else from the chat, and then I'll see if there's anything from the public on this component. Yes?
Under the Sigma documentation, it has under definitions, it talks about interconnected surface water. And the term significant is concerning to me because, and that's old, section O. It says interconnected surface water, hydraulically connected, but it finishes the sentence as completely depleted. So it leads me to believe that a significant interconnected surface water, it only is significant as a problem if it's completely depleted. That's what it says, sort of. But it's that significant, it's vague.
It's vague, and it's purposely vague from in the regulations because of local control. It's not an easy conversation to determine locally what is significant and unreasonable. Right? You're going to know if you have a problem, but your setting of your minimum threshold is going to be a values-based discussion. You know, we're already having these conversations in a place like Cedar Valley where there's a lot of angst about technical information that shows subsidence. But it's not like the San Joaquin Valley, you know, it might be up to 2 feet of subsidence or something like that. And they have to decide, what is going to be the basis for you to determine? You have a subsidence issue. It's not a big problem compared to other places, but it could become a bigger problem over time. So what are you going to set as your minimum threshold? Is it once we see that there's damage to infrastructure, we consider that significant and unreasonable? Do all of us in this valley think that anything below 1 foot of subsidence is unreasonable? Right? So they have to decide for themselves what they consider to be unreasonable, like what is their own risk assessment. And that is purposely vague. We're going to have to, that has to be defined locally. But you're right, it is vague. Anything else? How about from the public of this segment of our discussion? Yes, Dan?
One, there's 357 GSAs.
Thank you.
Yeah.
357. Okay. So you can never work for Dino. I have to help you here, Dan. You can never work for Dino for how long?
Yeah, about
25. 25 years before retiring. It's just such a font of information. And so I know you're here as a private citizen and you no longer work for the department, but thank you.
Yeah, I was just going to say a lot of times what distinguishes significant is the effect on the users and uses of that water, whether it be the surface water or groundwater.
But would you agree, Dan, with how I characterize that it does still need to be that needs to be locally defined?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And thank you for, you know, saving the time of looking up anything else from the public on this? Okay, great. Well, I'll turn it over to you, Kelly, and I didn't bring a clicker, so you just use the down arrow. I can do it for you if you want.
Sure. Yeah, you don't mind.
Yeah, you just...
Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes for this presentation and another 10 minutes for the following, so it's going to be pretty high level, pretty brief, and all of these things we will be getting into, diving more into the details at our following meeting, so just keep that in mind as we move through it. We'll be just going through an overview of the Minas Sub-Basin briefly, looking at a map of some of our land uses and irrigated land water sources so we understand sort of the lay of the land, as well as taking a brief look at some of the inflows and outflows into this basin that we're discussing. And then we'll look at a few maps, some of those heat maps that you guys have probably been familiar with from some of our other meetings that look at our changes from year to year, from last year to this year, and then also looking back, you know, about 15, 16 years ago to this year, so we can kind of see what those conditions look like. So real quick overview, this is a sub-basin of this larger Sacramento Valley groundwater basin. It's about 185,000 acres. It's entirely located within the county. generally valued up to the north by Tehama County, that boundary there. Sacramento River generally is where it follows along the west side, and then it comes down farther along and to the south here, that follows the Western Canal Water District boundary. That's how that's set. And then on the east side, that's where the alluvial subbasin has been defined by DWR and their bulletin 118 boundaries. So that's where our east side is sort of is set, and that's set by bulletin 118 as published by DWR.
Mm-hmm. So just to note, this is Rock Creek Reclamation District, separate GSA. Your stakeholder advisory committee for the final GSA.
And we're all within the same subbasin.
All within the same subbasin.
So moving on, we'll look at a little bit of the land use here. This is, I believe there's some maps in the back if you didn't happen to grab one. But there's quite a bit of irrigated lands you can see here in the Vinus subbasin. It's mainly dominated by the purple, which I don't know if you can see that from back there, but that's our walnuts. This light orange color here, almonds, come down this area. We do have some rice on the outskirts of our southern boundaries here. And then it's really dominated by prunes, alfalfa, greens, pasture. Of course, we've got our urban areas here in the Chico, and that's a really light green, so it's kind of hard to see that here. But we've got some urban areas here in the Chico area that's here of influence, as well as, I don't think the Durham area really shows up too well on here, but there's pasture of that. And then we've, of course, got riparian wetlands and, you know, all these other areas that are whited, kind of this white color, are non-irrigated. So just to give you an idea of what that is. And here, this is a map of our water sources. So of those irrigated lands that we just looked at, this gives you a really good idea of where the water's coming from to get those crops growing. The blue indicates areas that are provided water by groundwater. So you can see it's not 100%. So just to clarify that, I know that's been thrown around a couple of times. But it's pretty mainly dominated by groundwater in this area. The green you can see sort of along these boundaries here by MT. This is an MT range area. This is surface water area. There's some pieces up here as well. But as you can see, this Vinus subbasin mostly irrigates lands using groundwater pump to be able to provide that. And minimal amounts of irrigated lands are used by surface water. So how much water is used? That's the next question, right? So if we look at, this comes from our 2016 water inventory analysis, and a great deal of work was put into to that document. If you would like to see it, it's on our website under reports. There's a lot of really good resources there to dig into. But over a 14-year period, there was about 250,000 acres of irrigated lands in the Vinus subbasin. And let me just back up by saying, this is actually just a small, well, it's not a small piece. It's when we developed the what we call sub-inventory units as part of the BMO program, there was a Vina piece, and it didn't include all of our current Vina sub-basin. But this is the most accurate information we have at this time until we get that basin setting work out. So it's, what would you say, percentage-wise?
Yeah, so this is actually updated. We added up the different sub-inventory units to roughly match our new Vina sub-basin.
Right, so you're right.
This is about 250,000 acre feet of ground of water is used in Vina sub-basin.
Right, because we put the MT one in there, and that's one of those as well.
MT's out, but Durham Bay,
yeah.
We kind of have them together.
Yeah.
So these are rough numbers. Expect them to change when we bring kind of updated basin setting numbers. Obviously, water use varies from year to year, so when you look at any given year, numbers are different. And then this is an average from 2000 to 2014, and I think we're going to look at kind of the last 20 years for historical baseline average. So you'll see in the basin setting work, I believe the averages will be 1999 to 2018 for a 20-year period. So
in general, most of the water is used for agriculture. 88% from this figure and 12% for municipal and adult or domestic supplies.
So from that previous map that you had, the groundwater and surface water, this is only the groundwater coverage, correct? This is only that dark blue area?
Yes. Correct.
It's not the green.
The yellow is the sub-basin boundary, yes.
I think this is where it's headed to, and this probably should be a different color, but that's this.
But yes, the numbers are relating to the groundwater portion of that, yes.
How many acres are in the basin?
About 185,000. Total.
So if 88% of the water is being used for ag, that's only about 1 acre fruit?
But only about 45% of the basin, I think, is irrigated.
Okay.
Because there's all that. On the other side of 99, there's all that rain.
We could have that.
Water source.
Right, so this area is what we're talking about, that's not. That's not irrigated. All right, that makes more sense.
Okay.
So we talked a little bit about the groundwater, the land surface water budget. We talked about inflows to the land surface and outflows of that. So if we talk about inflows, it's really what sources of water are coming into the Vina sub-basin. And so we can think about water coming in as precipitation, right? So that's this majority of the pie here, that's about 180,000 acre feet of the water that comes into this area is through the rain. We did see those little pieces, those green pieces of surface water. So when folks, divert surface water, use that on the ground, that's another source of water that comes onto the land. And that's a very small piece of the portion here. Groundwater is an interesting concept. So actually, as we pump the groundwater up out of the ground and apply that to the land, that's our source of water onto the land. And that's this piece here, this peak, which is about 109,000.
Now these numbers are just for the old Vina sub-basin, so I kind of ignore these numbers.
Okay, but in general, we do a sense of where the water is coming into the land and then where it goes also. So once we understand what's coming onto the land, we want to know what's happening to that water. And so these are sort of the pieces, some of the pieces that we talk about when we talk about water budget, but a lot of that water is evapotranspirated. So evaporated, transferred through the plants, and it ends up in our atmosphere through that process. And it's quite a big amount. It's pretty surprising to me actually when I look at that. We talk about the percolation, which is the water that is pulled down into the soil, but not used in that root zone by the plants that are using them. That's what gets recharged down into our soils. And so that's a big portion of it as well. And then when we talk about runoff and return flow, if you think about precip falling off the ground and running down our creeks and running down our streams, that's our runoff. Our return flow is a little bit trickier, but in essence, if you think about maybe irrigating an orchard and some of that moves its way through the soil laterally and then pops out somewhere else. Or
maybe surface return flow.
Surface return flow, yeah, as well. So, Some of the concepts, we're going to get into the details of water budgets and et cetera as we move forward, but this is just sort of that high level, and I'm over time, so I'm going to keep going. I'm going to talk a little bit about, these are the same types of things that we've been looking about, sources and destinations. This is another way of looking at that, understanding that the water that comes onto our, the water that comes onto the land here, this is, for example, this is our surface water. And you can see throughout the years, this is 2000 down to 2014, the red boxes indicate the dry years, dry, low, normal, and critical years. But as you can see throughout the different type of water years and the water year types, the surface water doesn't change much in this area. Here, our groundwater, you can see, you can kind of make out some patterns here that we do apply more groundwater in drier years, which makes sense because we have less precipitation
in these years as well too. So as we have a drier system, we use more groundwater to do that. And this is basically a numerical way of saying it. All right. And this is that groundwater pumped and applied to the land surface that we talked about. So just real quick, I'm going to go through some of these maps that some of you may have seen recently. So this is a map basically looking at one point in time to another point in time. This is looking at last summer to this summer. And this is looking at groundwater levels in wells that are about 100 to 450 feet deep. And that happens to capture most of our wells that we do monitor. What you'll see here is the green boundary of our Lamesa Basin. And here on the side, you'll see a color map to see what those changes look like. So if we compare, say, this well, which is pretty close to the Chico area, and we went out to that well last year and got a measurement, went out to the well this year in the summer to summer, apples, same well, we saw that there's a 16.9 foot difference between groundwater levels. So last year was a below normal water year. We didn't have as much precipitation runoff. This year we have a wet year, so we went out last year, saw it here. This year we saw it about 16.9, 17 feet higher. So that gives you an idea of just the change between those 2 years. So in general, between last year and this year, we had some pretty good increases. On average, the groundwater level change was close to 9 feet. So we can do the same look at just the deep wells. So those are wells that are below 600 feet and below, to see what kind of changes are happening in those lower portions of the aquifer as well. Same system, we're looking at summer 18 to summer 19, just the deeper wells. And you can see on average, those deeper areas also did have an increase in water levels, on average about 10 feet. However, it's also important to note that there's only, if we go back to the last slide, see here we've got 23 wells to really make up this data and kind of understand that better. When we go to our deep wells, we're only at about 11 here. So that goes to show that, for me, we need more monitoring wells that are deep in this area to understand what's going on and have those spaced out in a way that gives us more information. So that's what we'll be, this kind of information helps us move along with that. And then this next map, same Midas Sun Basin, we're still looking at 1 year to the next year, but instead of being last year to this year, we're going to go back to 2004, which is also a below normal year, just to give us sort of that long-term idea of how water levels have really done in those last 15 years, 16 years, where we've had a number of years where we've been in a drought. We've also had 5 years in there. But this gives us an idea of, again, most of our wells, we have about 14 in this, and on average, over that long-term span, we've had relatively insignificant declines in these wells. So that is, that's it for that. We're kind of running behind time, I'm sorry.
Just one question. On the eastern border, it's kind of out there, up in the hills somewhere. Was that established where the Lower Tuscan can still be seen in some of the deep valley cuts, canyon cuts, or how was that line established?
Oh, the line across to define the basin?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly, but I think that they map basically where the alluvial, what's on top, the alluvium on top transitions into the Tuscan probably. But I don't know if even Dan can speak for that. But
yeah, it was mostly a geologic boundary for the alluvial hits the bedrock there. And, there's a lot of discussion where you put that boundary. You can go up to the creeks a little bit, and it can be a lot like curvier than what that's showing.
I just know that Lower Tuscan's visible in Butte Creek Canyon down there, but then north of there, I don't somebody's kind of doing a little guessing and...
Yeah.
Well, it's not just the, what formation it is either, right? Because the Tuscan outcrops on the east side and then it dives, right? But, so it's also more the nature of the material, whether it's an alluvial groundwater basin, sand groundwater, or whether it's more of a fractured rock system. So, in our case, the Tuscan is both of those things in different places. So the sub-basin boundary is trying to identify where it's actually the alluvial basin. And that's of uncertainty, which is becoming an issue, pretty significant issue in some ways, on the west side of Valley where they put in fees associated with Sigma implementation. And the guys on the west side are saying, hey, are we really in the basin here? And so we haven't kind of, we haven't run into that here because we're not doing that, but yeah, there's some uncertainty there.
Okay, so Tom, you can tell me how much time I have, okay? Because I don't want to run into your...
No, that's okay, I wrote it along.
Okay.
So, how much do you really need to make the renovation?
I think I'll just kind of brush over a lot of these because we will be getting into the details more, but it'll give you a general idea of where we're moving and where we're going.
Okay,
so this is going to give you guys an idea of where we are with our GSP for the Midas Service. So we talked about the timeline. We're currently through our governance. You're the most recent part of the governance in Vina GSA. Welcome again and congratulations. So through from 2018 to 2020 right now, we're looking at these basin setting chapters. That's basically going to come out in early spring, as you can see in the agenda on the second page. The second piece of that is going to be a new RFP with a new, possibly a new consultant team that's going to go through the entire process of setting that sustainable management criteria that Tanya talked about. And we talked about the objectives and the thresholds and these local conversations and where we want those to be. That's going to be coming in later in 2021. So if we look at our agenda right now and sort of the things that are in front of us, I'm really focusing on basin setting portion until we move to that next phase. However, at that next phase where we're setting those levels, it'll be here with you guys. And working towards the 2022 deadline in January to get the GSP completed.
Can I just jump in there? Go back really quick.
Sure.
So you said we're going to be working on sustainable management criteria at the end of 2021?
So between 2020, so next year, probably in summer, fall, through 2021, we'll be working on setting the sustainable management criteria. Yes.
Okay. It just seemed like it was bumping up against the fence a little. So I'm just trying to figure out the process because part of the plan is projects to help bring you to sustainability. It seemed like creating the criteria needs to be...
At this point, the projects... projects and actions piece of that for the first GSP submittal really can be pretty list-like, you know, so not necessarily having to be flushed out completely.
Okay.
But yeah, we're thinking that in fall, summer and fall of 2020 through summer of 2021 is when we'll be really creeping through that portion of it. So just to kind of set the frame of where we're at, what we're going to chew through now, and what we're going to chew through next year and fall.
Okay.
Yes.
Could you explain to me what basin setting means?
Sure. In fact, that'll be coming up in our future slides. I'll go through that a little bit more.
You know, I forgot to mention that, so you don't have to, if a queue forms, I usually do this. If you want, you can put your table tent on its side if you have something to say, so you don't have to worry about raising your hand. Let's see if that works. I usually do that. Okay.
So just background, Butte County on behalf of all the GSAs received a $1.5 million grant from DWR to implement the GSPs. And we're doing that with staff consultants and facilitation services with this extensive public process.
Okay.
these are the components of the GSP. Basin setting, the basin setting portion, go ahead, Tony, is the piece that we're currently working on right now with the consultant team, which is in place. And these are the pieces that are going to be rolled out to you coming up in our future meetings, as well as portions of the monitoring network, except for this piece here. Representative monitoring is not part of this current effort. These other portions are included in the current work of the consultants. This is one of those four pieces that you saw on there. This is the hydrogeological and conceptual model. Basically, what we have to describe about our sub-basin is what it looks like underground. What is the infrastructure? What do we know about it in terms of where the water lies, where the sediments lie, what is under there that influences what we have and what we can use, etc. So it will include maps and also cross-sections that depict our understanding of where our different layers, clays, sand, and gravels actually are. The next portion of the basin setting work that's being currently worked on is a description of the current historical groundwater conditions. So that's going to include a whole slew of maps, hydrographs, pumping patterns, understanding our groundwater change in storage, water quality issues that we know exist. We'll be looking at subsidence in this effort and identifying the interconnected surface waters and groundwater. So that's something that right now the consultant team is working on, and you will have that in front of you to understand how that work is being done and what it looks like. Another portion of that is understanding our groundwater dependent ecosystems. And those are areas, if you consider vegetation, wetlands, that are dependent on use of groundwater. We're currently underway in identifying what areas in the Vina sub-basin have those groundwater-dependent ecosystems, and writing portions to understand how to characterize those and protect those based on what they are.
Quick question on trying to understand the time frame for, because this is a lot of baseline setting, right?
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
So just trying to understand how far back are you looking to change in the delta storage, et cetera, or quality issues? How far back are you looking to create that baseline for that delta?
Yeah, so the law describes having a baseline or that historical and not current. And so that's some of what we're talking about is how you define this. So I think we're looking for the historical to do that last 20 years. And then current will be probably the most recent or a mix of the most recent that not are representative.
And just, and I know I'm probably asking a really pedantic question, but are all the GSI 356 GSA, seems like a very California way to do things.
Uh-huh.
is everybody required to do their baseline setting the same way? I assume in a lot more. Is that
no, exactly.
We all just get to make it up as we go.
Will not serve us well to just make it look pretty, right? Because ultimately, it's the monitoring that's, that we're going to have to line up. So we want to be, we want to, I think, accurately represent our understanding of conditions.
I have a separate question about coordination, but it's not relevant to what we're trying to get through, so I'll just wait on that.
That's what I was trying to make. So is the collaboration with the adjacent basin going to happen staff to staff, or this level, you know, is there any vision of us meeting similar committees at some point?
Yeah.
Joining basins?
Really us here.
Sierra.
I suppose it's a good place to meet.
So I know there's a PAC in the Glen County portion of the Coosa Basin and a PAC in the Coosa County portion of the Coosa Basin, and they've had co-meetings together, you know, coordinate about the Coosa Basin.
A TAC is a technical advisory committee.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's possible if there were certain issues, we could possibly have kind of a regional mix of groups. The IFWM may be a forum for having kind of a workshop on a regional, and so we would invite you all and encourage you all to attend, something like that. So I think we'll kind of see what the need is and are open to input on what might be best at different times, so depending on the topics.
And I could be wrong, but I believe in the second RFP where we're dealing with sustainable criteria, there is a piece in there on that consultant team working with our adjacent sub-basins to kind of have that apples-to-apples modeling, et cetera.
So that is happening at the staff level currently. There is overlap already with consultant teams working in these sub-basins, so that's useful. And then, yeah. I think there will be at the public level as in some way.
George, just to speak to how the governance fits into this, there's just different governance in all of these basins now that it's been clearly defined in the Butte sub-basin, for example. We know that they have an advisory board that is a mechanism. You know, so it's, I think in Tama, they have their own thing in Corning. I'm working there too. We just put an advisory board in place. So it is just very new, and I think we'll see how that coordination shapes up. But such a good question.
The third piece of the basin study.
I have one question.
We've got our time. Sorry.
This has to do with the hydrologic setting of the model. Is this going to be limited to the final GSA geographic, or is it going to extend to throughout the whole actual dynamic hydrogeologic setting? I mean, is it going to cross the river into the Lake County?
No, I don't believe so, right?
Okay, so let's clarify first the model, right? So there's HCM, hydrologic conceptual model. That's our conceptual model description of how things work in the Vine Sub-Basin, but in the context of the Sacramento groundwater basin. So yeah, I think when we describe conditions in the Vine Sub-Basin, it has to be beyond. The groundwater model, so now we're talking about a numbers, math, numerical model, we're using the Butte Basin groundwater model. It only goes to the river, which means, and there was good discussion about advantages and disadvantages of choosing to use the Butte Basin groundwater model, and I'll bring you some of that more details at our next meeting. Or using a Sacramento Valley-wide, which is also available, groundwater model, which is what our neighbors are using. So because we chose to move forward with the Butte Basin groundwater model that has this pretty significant limitation of only going to the Sacramento River, we will also need to continue to have feedback with the Sacramento-wide groundwater model, which is good because it will force continued coordination at that very technical level with the Coosa Sub-Basin. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm sure you know what my concern is.
Yeah, right.
That,
so, yes.
That we need to be able to recognize if there's deep holes on the other side of the river that are interacting with our groundwater basin, the foundation of our charged aquifer, our confined aquifer. We need to be aware of it, we need to prepare for it, we need to plan our monitoring systems so that we can determine if things happening 5 miles that way are this has to be part of the planning process.
Yes.
So our model, our concept of how the hydrology works, which is what I think it's a hydrologic conceptual model,
yes.
has to include the dynamics of what's happening when there are deep cones of depression within our aquifer system, our regional aquifer system. You have to be aware of that, plan for it, monitor for it.
Yeah, I totally agree. So that will be, yeah.
And Bruce, thank you, Jim, Bruce.
Yeah, are you planning to integrate the information or a lot of it from the AEM study into the hydrologic model?
Yes, so Bruce mentioned the AEM study, which we'll affectionately call the helicopter project.
That's what I do.
I think a lot of people decide on buying into that. So we flew helicopter, collected geophysical data over portions of the Bayan Subbasin, also a little bit of the Corning Subbasin, really right along that basin boundary, both piece of Corning, Fosa, and the Butte Subbasin, so kind of that nexus there. So we will absolutely milk that data set for informing our higher geologic conceptual model. So it's really good location for getting at what Jim was just talking about as well. In a longer term project, so kind of starting out for the next 3 years, Stanford is looking at how to integrate that data set into numerical models. And so that will not happen until after we have to get this plan done. The initial GSP done, but this is a long game, right? So the Butte Basin, I mean, this is the first important point is that any tool that we use is going to continue to get better and change, and therefore the numbers that come out of that tool are going to continue to get better and change as well. So hold those things lightly as our best current understanding that are useful and informative, but we will continue to get better in our understanding of this complex system. So answer that question, in the long run, yes, in this next year for this current basin setting, not going to be included in the basin ground model.
But maybe the fiber optic.
But the fiber optic.
The water budget information is another portion of the basin setting, and I won't go into the details of this because you will have that coming to you in more detail, but it's really a understanding of inflows, outflows, change in storage, looking at historical current and also future projections and scenarios and what that entails. It'll consider climate change, land use change, population, and surface water availability, amongst other things. And the fourth piece is looking at management areas. So this is also engaging the public on what these draft sort of management areas should be. These are allowed for by SGMA to basically have different measurable objectives, different minimum thresholds based on either land use type, based on geology, based on things that make sense. So in our first sort of look at this, you know, we think maybe potentially the city of Chico, which has different water use types and different jurisdiction, might be treated differently than the areas north of Chico, for example. They haven't been decided right now. These are draft management areas, and that would be something that the public and you are all involved in helping decide as well, too. Once we have those numbers from all of this work from the consultant team to help inform that, you know, they'll bring some of their best ideas right by you guys to help inform that as well. Monitoring networks, basically a description of our current monitoring network. Right now, Butte County has over 20 years of monitoring data and a history of extensive history of a lot of groundwater level, water quality, and subsidence monitoring data to pull from. So it'll be a description of those efforts. Let's see, monitoring protocols is basically, here's how you monitor what you do. That actually is a first draft GSP chapter that is available for review, so that'll be coming to you guys shortly after this meeting for discussion and delivery. Representative monitoring, as we talked about, is a future activity in that next phase of work with a possibly new consultant team. And assessment improvement really looks at our monitoring network, identifies the gaps. Like we just discussed a few of those today. We can look at spatial gaps. We can look at, you know, are we missing some of our vertical depths that give us an understanding of those confined aquifers versus our shallow wells. Steps to fill the gaps and a description of, you know, how often they should be monitored and where the density of those monitoring sites are. So the GSP completion project, so that's what we're talking about, this next phase with the new RFP that will include sustainable criteria. That's probably going out, we're going to fly that probably in January, and then hopefully that one will be in place and under contract by spring. So other work in the Minas Sub-Basin, if you're interested, there's all these great monitoring reports, recharge, the AEM, the inventory analysis. All these reports are on the website that I spoke about earlier. If you go to our website and go to reports, you can find all of these there. With that, we are wrapped.
So there's going to be a lot of information coming at you, right, over the next couple of years. You're trying to sort of get a sense of that, right? But today, it's not going to be so sort of one-directional, right? We're just trying to give you background information. So I felt like it was important to make you know that. Is there anything else about the presentation Kelly made before we move on to really clarifying your roles and responsibilities on this committee? Okay, there's going to be a lot more. Let's take a look. Trying to work my two computers here. Alright. One of the things that I want to mention is that the VinaGSA.org website is a new website that just went live, I think, Thursday. And so we are going to get even better about making sure that all of the information that you need is either there or linked, whether it's to the county's website or anywhere else. So Cami and I will be working together on that. And in the future, when you get information, I will send you like a PDF of the agenda with all of the materials that you'll be using, and I will live link them. They will all be separate on that website, but I want to link them, like, because I want you to be able to click onto the charter and for you to go directly there. I know that it was a little bit, some of you struggled with how the materials went out this time, so I appreciate your attention. So I hope you've had a chance to look at your draft charter. This charter, I'm interested in seeing if we have enough agreement about this charter to determine if you can make a recommendation to the Bina Groundwater Sustainability Agency. The GSA board is one that will approve your charter, but we need to make sure that we have agreement here about sort of what it says. So hopefully you had a chance to look at it. And that was a very sensitive mouse. Okay. So just on the purpose, I'm not going to read through all of this, but it is important for you to understand that, as your name suggests, you're here to provide input and recommendations to the groundwater sustainability, the Bina Sub-Basin GSA board, on both the plan and then its implementation. Now, your charter, I've been involved with advisory committee similar to this, where, you know, once you finish with the development of the plan, sort of your role in implementation may slightly change. So at that point, we'll probably revisit the charter, like in 2 years, to see if it needs a refresh. But as for the development of the planning process, you really are here to to provide any input in the plan, so you'll see it in draft form, and to make recommendations to the GSA board. And then this just gives you a sense of sort of the areas where you will be providing review and recommendations, right? Development and adoption of the GSP, and then all of the things that we're talking about today, and then future, future events. And for example, if there were local regulations, or if there were fees being contemplated, right? All of those things would come here for your discussion. That would be those would be future topics. So any questions about really what the purpose of this committee is? Let's see if I can scroll without it having a fit. I'll use the arrow. okay, and as I already mentioned before, this committee is a Brown Act compliant, so it is a public committee, and it will always be noticed as such. And in terms of the roles and responsibilities, I think it's important for you to understand how you fit in. So the agency, that is the Vina GSA Board of Directors, they have in their founding document, their joint powers agreement, which is a legal document, they have committed to the value of this committee, and they have also stated that they will consider your recommendations. And if they decide, it's ultimately their decision, if they adhere to your recommendations, if they decide not to, they actually need to explicitly state why they did not adhere to those recommendations. So there can be a discussion. It does. That is what they have committed to. Now, the advisory committee, that's you. Your role and responsibility, as it says there, is to solicit and incorporate community and stakeholder interest into your recommendations. So you are here sort of representing, some of you are here representing your actual organization. Others of you represent agricultural ground users or domestic well users or environmental uses. And one of the responsibilities is really for you to not only come to these meetings, but for you to be talking to other folks, you know, in the business community, in ag, in the environment, and domestic well users as sort of ambassadors to provide information, encourage them to come, also keep your ear to the ground to understand what their concerns are so that you can bring some of those here. There will be times when we have community workshops where it'll be a sort of come y'all, you know, and we'll get people to come to these. But this role of understanding that you do have sort of a community constituency. And there is a criteria for your members. We're really looking for folks to serve as strong advocates for your interest group, to work collaboratively with all others here, to commit your time, the time needed, and to collectively try to understand each other's interests. There will be differences, particularly when we get to sustainable management criteria discussions, and we really want to get to a point where when you're thinking about your perspective, you're also weighing the other interests of the community, right? This all needs to fit together. And then this is just basic stuff, right? So you arrive at the meetings on time, make sure that you're presenting constituent views, bring a problem-solving approach, and keep your constituents and others in your interest group informed. Now the management committee, which is another important part of this whole governance structure in the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency, there are representatives from that management committee here. There will always be staff from the three member agencies who staff your committee. And that means that they'll work with me to prepare presentations. They will, as you can see here, they'll maintain your roster. They'll work with the agency board to fill vacancies when that occurs. They'll prepare agendas and they'll notice the meetings and compliance with Brown Act. They will staff all all meetings, and we will make sure that we record and provide documentation from the meetings. We're going to develop a work plan so you know what's up ahead, and they will make sure that your recommendations are brought up to the board so that everything that you do here goes up to the board for their consideration and it all happens in a timely way. We'll see if we need any ethics and Brown Act trainings, right? Just to make sure you understand that part of your role. And of course, we're maintaining a record of all meeting materials, and they will be available to the public on the new website. It says there, as resources allow, a third-party facilitator, that's me, will be provided to the shack. I am here, and right now, the VINA GSA, through Butte County at the moment, is working to see if they can get facilitation support services through DWR's program to help continue with third-party services. And the intent there is for me to be working with the whatever the advisory committees are in all three of the sub-basins, because that has an efficiency associated with it to figure out how it all sort of fits together and can coordinate. Then I think you know about the membership composition, and hopefully you've read this. This is determined through the development of the VINA GSA governance, that some of the members of the committee would be appointed and some of them would be at-large members. And we see that this committee is fully seated at the moment. There are 10 members originally. It said that so you are at your maximum number, not to exceed 10. That can be changed, however, if the circumstances shift, the board could make changes. And so you can see all of those representatives there. And I think you know what the member appointment process was. You just went through it. If you're a non-at-large member, you were appointed. And if you were at-large, you went through an application process. And then that application process occurred. So you have 4-year terms. They're 4-year terms, but you're not term limited. Some of you will just keep doing this for the next 20 years. You guys think so, you're like, oh, Lord. However, at each term, members need to resubmit. It's just sort of like a recommitment or time to consider if that's what you might continue doing. And you should note here that shack members who serve at the will of the agency board, and it is up to them if they wish to remove any shack member. And that would occur by a supermajority vote of the board. Okay, let's talk about decision making, and this is something that I want to make sure that we're all really clear about. So we're going to see consensus at these meetings, but you don't have to achieve consensus, right? If you do not achieve consensus on any of your recommendations, then it becomes our job to clearly articulate where the areas of agreement and disagreement are and send those up to the agency board. If they want further clarification, they may send it back to you for further clarification. So understand that consensus is what we are attempting to achieve here, but it will not stop the process. So I want to stop there before I get into any, just of these process agreements and ground rules. I think it's important for all of us to know what those are and to agree to them. So are there any questions, particularly around decision making, but in anything, or questions or comments, and anything that I've presented about your charter? George?
So as time, I assume that this is an agenda item that we're be here and join and show up and provide input. It happens on the Water Commission and Canvas. It's not an uncommon rule.
Yeah.
So if you miss three consecutive meetings, we're going to go find someone that will participate.
Okay, I think we have some business in the original language. Does the staff want to inform why there may have been that change? Or?
So that was the only way any members could be removed from the board originally, as you recall from the bylaws. And then they said, well, we'd like to open that up to be able to really have discretion over that. So I think that could still be. I think it was the intent to add half both. We just apparently just lost it in the transition. But it was always going to be, three. That was given. I don't think the board had any problem with that. But they wanted to go the next step to have some other options to that. So I think it was just one that we just forgot to fill.
We can bring it back to them for consideration.
Yes, sir.
I recommend we make it clear. You missed 3 years. We want someone else.
Okay, does everybody support that, realizing that you can see how much information was shared today? It's going to get more and more technical. Actually, there's going to be a lot of information, so when you miss three consecutive meetings, that is maybe three chapters of the GSP. So is there anyone who objects to it, that including if you miss three consecutive meetings of the SHAC, that you would be removed from the committee?
How often are we having these meetings? I mean, if you call three meetings in 1 week, and I'm in the Lowell Harvest, guess what?
Yeah.
I'm not going to be there.
So if you look at the meeting framework, you can see that we are proposing on the second page of the agenda that we're proposing the next meeting would be in February, and then there would be monthly meetings.
Okay.
And then they would occur once a month through May, and then we'll assess where we are at that point. We may find that we need to continue with monthly meetings. We may go to every other month when we get to the summer. So it would never be more than, I don't want to say something where I'm putting myself into a kind of corner, but I don't expect that they would be more than one per month.
Because you're
not. Yeah, no, I'm not with that. I have served on the school board where all of a sudden you have in 1 month one meeting will have 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to make all of them. So.
And I think it's important to have a sensitivity to what's happening during the growing season as well. We will see once we get to May. I had originally proposed that we hold them every other meeting, and then we realized, given what's in front of us, that the next 6 month schedule needed to be like this.
Yeah.
Great. So realizing that you would not most likely meet more than once a month, it sounds like we have agreement to add this provision that if you miss three consecutive meetings of the SHAC that you would be removed. Yes?
The only thing we could do if it helped, we could just maybe add some language to us the same way in circumstances of the board or something to the effect if something came up that applied to certain parameters.
Yes. Yeah. That might be nice to do that. I just think that's right. That's things occur. Would you be okay with that sort of language, unless extenuating their extenuating
to present? Who decides what's
extenuating?
Is that what you're
going to say? Determined by the board. Okay, wow. That was our first consensus decision. all right. Any other suggestions for refinement, changes, or questions about everything through decision making? Okay. This is your governing document, so that's why I'm taking the time to go through it in this way, instead of just saying, did you read it? Do you have questions? You know. And here are the process agreements. We will not go through our ground rules and process agreements every time, but I am going to go through them this time because I will enforce them, and I want to make sure that we have that they're consensual, right? As it says there, in And as you can see there, everyone agrees to negotiate in good faith. All participants agree to participate in decision-making, to act in good faith in all aspects of this effort, and to communicate their interests during meetings. Good faith also requires that members are not make commitments that do not intend, they do not intend to follow through with, and that members act consistently in the meetings and in other forums where issues under discussion in these meetings are also being discussed. Right, so if you agree to something in these meetings, but then you go to another meeting and you counter what was agreed to in this meeting, that would be an example of someone's concern that you might not be acting in good faith in these negotiations. Everyone agrees to address, the second one is to address the issues and concerns of the participants. Everyone who is joining the advisory committee is doing so because he or she has a stake in the issue at hand. For the process to be successful, all members agree to validate the issues and concerns of other members and strive to reach agreement that takes all issues under consideration. Disagreements will be viewed as problems to be solved rather than battles to be won. Number three, everyone agrees to inform and seek input from their constituents about the outcome of the facilitated discussions to the extent possible. Scheduling will allow for members to inform and seek input from their constituents and others about decisions. Right, so I'm sure that many of you are in other forums, right, where you are able to sort of talk to folks. I think for domestic well users, it may be more difficult. You know, we can talk more about what that might mean for you. But in other ways, you know, I'm sure that agricultural ground users, you're a part of other agricultural organizations where you can be talking to folks about what's going on here or encouraging them to come. It's really trying to be an ambassador in that way. The next one is everyone agrees that members can meet with other organizational or interest group members. SHAC members may find it helpful to meet with other organizations or interest groups. Members to consult with constituents outside of the meeting so that the member is better able to communicate community concerns and issues at hand. So if there's something that comes up in the meetings where you feel like you really need to touch base with somebody to better understand their perspective or you know, their concerns, then you're welcome to do that. Okay, then the last one in the process agreement, everyone agrees to attend all meetings to the extent possible, and we've just already talked about the three-meeting rule, continuity of the conversations and building trust are critical to the success of the SHAC. Members are encouraged, and that's just, you know, seldom courtesy, and focus on the issue at hand. Agency staff or the facilitator will coordinate the meeting schedule. Okay, anything about process agreements that you have that you would like to discuss or refine or change?
Just a question, one thought. On the second to the last bullet, it might be worth, I know that it's in other sections of the document, but it might be worth saying something to the effect of within limits of the Brown Act. So on that second bullet, you know, meeting, if we end up with a meeting and half of this advisory committee is present at that meeting and it's not a publicized agenda,
yeah,
or then, so I guess just being cognizant of that.
Let's go ahead and add that, right? Because, and I realize that we had more on the agenda today than we're going to get to, and that's okay. But we are actually going to talk more about the Brown Act to make sure that you're clear about what the provisions are under the Brown Act. I did, of course, in the agenda, live link, you know, information about the Brown Act that it would be great if you could consult, but I think that that's a good addition. Does everybody support that addition? I think it makes good sense. Okay, anyone opposed? Okay, we'll go ahead and include that. Thank you for noting that. Anything else on those process agreements that you, it's like, you have any discomfort with or feel like we should discuss?
I'm just curious about the management committee. Will it always be composed of three individuals? Is that how it's going to work? I'm not clear staff, I see, but Paul Gosman is staff also, so does that mean there's going to be four, including five, including Kristen, or just
okay,
three? So you'll represent Butte County.
Right.
City, that's basically what's going to happen most of the time.
At least, yes. So we have, like I said, we have two members representing Chico, then there's multiple representing the county, and then there's a couple representing Durham, but, so we'll have at least one member at these meetings. We're kind of dividing, conquering, Eric's got another water meeting right now, so I think that's part of the call is also, so. Unless we felt the need that all this meeting there, I couldn't see the need to have everybody, unless you want to.
And I'll be here, I'm not really officially part of the management committee, so I'll be here mostly bringing GSP comment for people.
And maybe we're adding just that refinement for clarity that at least one staff member from each of the member agencies, and there are three member agencies that make up the Pomona GSA, will staff the meetings, right? Because it's important that the information gets to their respective member agencies, right? The city, the county, and Durham Irrigation District. Really good question. Okay, anything else on the process agreement? All right, then the ground rules is just, standard ground rules. I'm not going to go over them the way I did with the process agreements. It's really asking for your common courtesies, realizing that all viewpoints have value. And I ask you to be as candid as possible, because we're trying to build mutual understanding, and there will be some difficult conversations, because there's a lot to grapple with in these natural resources conversations. Avoiding editorials, as tempting as that can be, honoring time, being concise, thinking innovatively, we need creativity to when we're starting to address these problems. And of course, we always invite humor. It's a good thing, levity, in these collaborative discussions. Okay, a last thing is that we can amend this charter. You can, if something changes or you realize that something's not working and how you operate, you can suggest changes. Or if I feel like something's not working or needs to be clarified, I can bring a recommended change to you that you would then recommend to the Vining GSA board for them to make the change. All right. I thank you for your patience in going through this. Oftentimes folks, find these governance conversations a little tedious until they realize that something's wrong, right? And then everyone gets serious about governance. Anything else you feel that we need to discuss or changes we should make, we have made a few refinements that we will capture. And I will make the process for having you look at this is, I will make those refinements as noted today, send it back out to you for you to look at. And if anyone has any concerns, I'll give you a deadline. If you have any concerns about it, then I'd like for you to raise it via email. Otherwise, right now, if you're comfortable with this, the changes, I would like to see if you can make a recommendation to approve the charter, knowing that the inclusion of those changes will occur in the interim. Because we'd like to send it up to the board the next time that they meet.
When is the board?
They meet in May, so if you wanted to bring it back.
Oh, we have plenty of time. I can bring it back to you. I just didn't want it to delay, to cause a delay. So what I'll do is I will bring it back to you. I will make the changes. I will still send it. I will send it out then with the February packet with the changes. And then we will do a final approval then. I expect it will be a very fast item at that point. But since we have the time and it's not going to delay anything with the
board, there's no reason not to do that. Okay? All right, so that's what we'll do. We'll agendize it next time. All right, so now at the next, at the February meeting, we will also spend a little bit of time on the Brown Act and the Stakeholder Communications and Engagement Plan. I don't anticipate that we will spend much time on that. The Stakeholder Communications and Engagement Plan is an information item for you. It has already been adopted by the board. You are named, the shack is named in the Communications and Engagement Plan. I need to make sure that you know what it says about you and your role in stakeholder engagement. So we won't spend much time on that next time, but it will be on the agenda. So before we wrap it up, because we will always honor your time here, even if you can't get through the entire agenda, I wanted to just look at the meeting framework. So this is the second page, or the third page actually, of your agenda. This is going to get tighter and tighter as we get more information. But we wanted to give you a sense of what's coming up. And so you can see in February that we're already going to start looking at draft GSP chapters around the space and setting for a big one.
They're not going to be chapters necessarily.
Oh, for monitoring. For the monitoring protocols for data collection and monitoring, that you'll be looking at that draft chapter. It's not, and in subsequent meetings, they might be component parts of other chapters, right? But for February, that is the case. Yeah. So we need to just set a schedule so that so that the actual dates are there. I hope that this will just be the location.
This is an option if this is helpful for you. We also have our conference room too in the other council chamber building. The availability of this room is probably more likely than that one, but we can meet that one if this is helpful for everybody.
Is this room fine for everyone? Yeah, great. It's a nice circle building, isn't it? Okay. Today is a Tuesday, and how are 10 to noon? Is this an okay time for you, or is this a problematic time?
Will these usually be 2 hour meetings? I wasn't sure that just this one first one.
They will be at least two. They will be 2 hour meetings. Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be on Tuesday.
Doesn't have to be. But it's going to be where I started, because if we could just have it be, you know, sort of this day going forward, then we may as well do it.
Third Tuesday. 9 to noon.
Third Tuesday, 9 to noon. It's 10 to noon, but whole 9 to noon,
yeah.
Right? Because there may be cases where we realize it might take a little more time. It's never going to take less than 2 hours.
The only thing about Tuesdays is that this handles abortion providers.
Yeah.
And so,
is it on
that conflicts with some of us going to things that they may have on their agenda.
Is it the third Tuesday?
Perfect.
Second and fourth.
Oh, second. Oh, this one was a special one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They met only one time, right? Yeah. But we definitely do not want to do that. We would not want to conflict with board of supervisors or other such meetings. But it sounds like it wouldn't, and it wouldn't conflict with City Council.
City Council's evening meetings.
Evening, yeah. Okay, and Durham has more Durham Irrigation District has more flexibility, right, with your schedule. Okay, so let's just put it out there. If not, I mean, if I have to do a doodle poll to actually tease this out a little bit, I can, but I figured I'd just try to see if this date works, the third Tuesday, generally from 10 to noon, but you could poll 9 to noon. Yeah, anyone have concerns with that date? Daytime?
Not with the date. Typically, this type of stuff, the later in the day can start, that's better for me, but
1-4, but we'll generally have them be 2-4. I just want to make space because I'm anticipating that some of these meetings will have to be 3 hours. Okay, so we'll have them be from 10, the third Tuesday of the month from 2-4. Yes? All right, Gary, you want to put in marks?
It just eliminates the second half of the day for a lot of things. This way, 10 to 12, noon, the day starts.
Yeah, you have more time for the rest of your...
Why don't you do a poll for the next one? Do a poll that worked. I thought that worked well, and then everybody can kind of...
But I can live with whatever.
Okay, you can... It sounds like either one of you could live with.
Yeah.
Yeah, either 10 to noon or 2 to 4. So we'll put out a doodle poll for you to contemplate it, and we'll see how that comes back. And we'll go with whoever, you know, where we have the greatest number of people. So we'll go for the third Tuesday, and we're going to put out a doodle poll for either the morning or the afternoon and see what you say. Okay?
I don't know how many people it affects the room, but the third Tuesday in March is over spring break. I don't know how many people have kids or... We might miss.
We might see people. I mean, those things will inevitably occur, right, with breaks. But I think we should proceed with the third Tuesday for now. And, we'll put it over. All right, well, we're afternoon, and I really want to thank all of you for joining, for being here, being a part of this committee, and of course, to work with you.
Thanks, too.